It's so easy in education to take a good idea and make it bad, and community schools has also faced as the same hurdles as other education strategies. And so it was very important for us to lean into implementations.
Hello and welcome to SchoolMade, the National Education Association's podcast dedicated to helping educators thrive in the early stages of their careers. I'm your host, Natika Samuels. Here at NEA, we get tons of questions from our members about lesson planning, classroom management, or even how to work with parents. But sometimes we get questions about bigger concepts like community schools, which is a promising trend in communities across the country. Today, to shed some light on the subject of community schools, what they are, how they work, and how they're helping communities, we're going to talk to NEA's Kyle Surrett, a senior policy analyst at NEA, and our resident community schools expert. Thanks for joining me, Kyle.
Great to be here with you.
So Kyle, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself and your background in education?
I was a chemistry teacher at one point, teaching 9th and 10th graders, and that's where I learned a whole lot. And you think as a teacher, that's where you're imparting knowledge, but I certainly learned a lot about the difference between understanding content and being able to deliver content to students. And after being a teacher, I was working the labor movement. So I spent a lot of time learning how to campaign to get stakeholders what they want. But my background is my dad worked in the labor movement and my mom's a judge.
So it seems like you're no stranger to the way that schools work or unions work.
Yes, it's familiar.
So now as a senior policy analyst at NEA, you spend a lot of time preaching the gospel about community schools. But for some people, I think that sounds mostly just like a buzzword. They don't actually know what that means. So since you're the expert in the room, can you give me an essential rundown of what community schools are and focusing on what the difference between a community school and a traditional public school might be?
Yeah, it's a great question. We've actually done the polling and no one knows what a community school is. Like everyone thinks it's a neighborhood school. But if you wanted to basically understand what a community school is, a general neighborhood school can become a community school by adding four basic components. One, they would hire this person called a community school coordinator. And that person, if I had to rename it, since it's not a very well-descripted thing, I'd say that they're the chief problem-solving officer that would work with stakeholders to do grassroots problem-solving and visioning. So number one, they would hire this person. The second thing they would do is do some big, deep, long work with stakeholders to get from them, what is their vision for their school? And what do they love about their school? Because a lot of times we tend to guess about what stakeholders want, what students, what educators, what families, what the community wants from their school. But community schools don't guess at it. They go and work deeply with stakeholders. The third thing that community schools do, they hire this coordinator, then they work with stakeholders to figure out their vision, and then they do grassroots problem solving. That's the unofficial way of saying it. And what they do is they think about the various problems that are standing between them and their vision, and they try to solve those problems, whether it's, I'm not happy when I walk into school, we need music, or something more complex, like our curriculum doesn't have any people that look like us in it, and how do we update that? And then the fourth is, sometimes at a community school, you're solving problems that are inside of a school, but a lot of times there are some problems that you need outside partners to help out with, whether it's a soccer partnership or someone who can help you redesign your curriculum. So the fourth thing is a collaborative structure to coordinate partnerships and stakeholders as they do all this complex work of making a community school run.
So could you give me an example or two of where community schools have worked really well? Because as you said, most people don't really know the difference between a community school and a traditional public school. So maybe people might not even know that there's a community school in their community and what that can really do. But do you have any examples?
Oh, plenty of them. Your audience might want to know that there are 99,000 public schools in the United States, and there are about 5,000 community schools in the United States. So a great example of community schools is in Cincinnati. In 2001, they passed a school board policy trying to turn all of their schools into community schools because they were, at that point, the lowest performing district. Only 50% of students were graduating, and test scores were low, for those who care about that stuff. and the achievement gap between their Black and white students was 14.5%. And today, all of their schools are community schools. Their achievement gap between their rich and poor, or Black and white, is now 4.5%. The graduation rate is up in the 80%, and it's the highest performing urban district in Ohio. So that's one example. Another example is Kentucky. Kentucky, in the early 90s, had an equity lawsuit filed against them. In order to settle that equity lawsuit, they passed the CARA Act. And what CARA did was turn 90% of Kentucky schools into community schools. So in the 90s, early 90s, this was a place where it had the most illiterate adult population, one of the biggest inequity gaps that exist between rich and poor outcomes. And today it's ranked 27th. It's one of the lowest places between inequity and equity. And so that's a whole state that accomplished it. So one other example, if I may, is in Austin, Texas. So there, I'd say around 10 years ago now, the superintendent wanted to close their two lowest performing schools, and that was Reagan High School and Webb Middle School. And the stakeholders of those schools, and for those who like, what are stakeholders? I'm just referring to the educators and what you think about like teachers and other support professionals like ESPs and the students and the families and the community said, we don't want you to close our school. We want you to make it better. And they came across the community school strategy and they said, this is what we want to use. So when they mobilized, they were able to win their traditional public school being turned into a community school. And today, they're the highest performing Title I schools in Austin. And Reagan High School is such a great example because they've doubled their enrollment and they used to have no AP classes. And this last year, 12 students graduated with an associate's degree before even graduating from high school. And there's tons of advanced placement opportunities. So the stakeholders from a grassroots up figured out a way to make their school what they wanted it to be.
It sounds like we've found the answer. So why do you think more people or more communities don't just go for community schools immediately?
It's mostly structural. So if you're a heart surgeon and you come up with a better mechanism for doing heart surgery, what ends up happening is it ends up in a journal and it ends up being in how heart surgery is done. But the way our school systems work is that if I'm that heart surgeon that figured out that magical new methodology and I run into another heart surgeon at the airport, I say, hey, I came up with something, then that heart surgeon knows. And so the network is very slow how it works in education. So we have 50 different silos, and let's just call those states. And then inside those states, we have 14,000 other silos, which we'll call school districts. And inside of those, we have 99,000 other silos. So just meaning that we're a decentralized mechanism for education, and there's no strong mechanism for sharing strategies that solve problems or create solutions, if you want to think of the positive way of saying it.
So how do you, in your position here, work against that or towards more community schools being developed or instituted? I'm not sure exactly what the verb should be there.
Formed. I do podcasts like this so everyone else will know. And aside from that, we have a three-part strategy that we work on. The first one is increasing the awareness of our affiliate presidents and staff that this strategy exists. So we do these things at the Leadership Summit, during webinars and podcasts and other mechanisms so that we increase awareness of the community school strategy and how to do it. The second thing we do is we provide grants to our affiliates and our partners to work on these projects. And then we support a professional learning community. So after you form these, it's so easy in education to take a good idea and make it bad. And community schools has also faced the same hurdles as other education strategies. And so it was very important for us to lean into implementations.
All right. Well, we need to take a quick break, but we'll be back in a second. Thanks for listening to School Me, and a quick thank you to all of the NEA members listening. If you have a question for one of our experts or just need some support as you're getting your career started, please leave us a message on our line at 240-780-8329. That's 240-780-8329. And your voicemail might be played on air. You can also email your question to us at schoolmeplease@nea.org. That's schoolmeplease, all one word, @nea.org. And we're back.
Great to be back.
So the focus of this podcast is early career educators. So for some of them who might be hearing about this for the first time or have not seen a community school in action, what do you want the younger teachers or younger ESP to know about the community schools model?
When you're in school to become an educator, everything is pictured in your mind. You still have idealness in your heart and idealness in what's going to happen. And then you land in schools and you realize you're in an institution that has many beautiful things and also many things that aren't working very well. And if you end up in a school where you not only have to be an educator, but you also have to be a bit of a parent, and you have to also be a bit of a social worker, and a bit of many other aspects of what to meet the needs of students. If you were in a community school, there are systems that make it so you can focus in on being the educator that you want the school to be, as opposed to being kind of many different roles that society forces on upon you.
If a educator is new to the profession, but say not in their first year, they've had a few years, let's say three or so under their belt, so they've started to sort of see the cracks. They're no longer in that complete idealized state that you were just referencing. And they think that moving to a community school model might be helpful for their school district. How would you suggest that an earlier career educator goes about bringing their school toward that model?
Great question. So there's a few components answers to that question that we figured out over the years. Number one is that if you do realize that you want to become a community school, and I do hope that someday we don't say community school, we're just saying school, and that's what all schools have, that you want to get engaged in your local union affiliate or local association and talk with your president about that if you're not the president already, and say, I know about a strategy that can help bring equity here. Let's work with some of the folks at NEA National to figure out a good strategy for us to become a community school here. So I say that's one way to do it. I think the second thing to think about is that oftentimes schools go down a path that doesn't directly align with their district strategy. So they're doing a strategy despite the district. And sometimes they pat themselves on the back for achieving despite what the district is doing to them. And I often find that it's a little bit better to go a little bit slower by building power and changing the dynamics within a district and within a school board and getting to a place that your school board and your superintendent love community schools and can't imagine a universe where your schools are not all community schools. So I think that there's a political and policy route that needs to happen, and I think that there's a route with your local association to engage with the leadership, go on a bit of a learning tour, and then figure out the step-by-step strategy to building the power and community school IQ locally so that stakeholders want to do it and rally behind it.
About the practical steps that someone might take. So you gave a good overarching idea of what a newer educator might do or the avenues they can go down. But what is the first step? Is it just a meeting? Is it, you know, secret note passing in the break room? Like, how does a person go from absolute zero, their own idea in their own heads, to gathering other people who want to join them in on this grassroots movement?
Mm-hmm. Great question. So I've seen it done in various ways to accomplish it. So one example, in Los Angeles, 4 years ago, they knew that they wanted to form community schools in Los Angeles. And I'll skip to the punchline. In the strike, they just won 30 new community schools. They knew in order to do that, they need to find a way to fund these in a place where a district is not used to taking a lot of direction from the union on school improvement. So they formed a coalition. It was called the Reclaim Our Schools LA Coalition. And that coalition worked with students and families and community members to figure out what their vision for public schools were. They passed the school board policy on it. And then they eventually, unfortunately, had to go on strike. But in the end, won 30 new community schools. And my bet is they'll continue to win more and more as they see the success of the strategy. But if those seem a little bit much to do, there are some things that you could just do very locally. Number one is we have model school board language that you don't have to recreate the wheel, that you can go to NEA.org and download a school board policy that would work just for you and your district. And then I would start to have conversations with stakeholders in and around the school, not necessarily about community schools, just about what they love about their schools and what their vision is. And if you notice that there's a difference between what they love about their school but what their current vision for their school is, then you can start talking about, even though we haven't accomplished this here, other places have accomplished it, and there are several reports that have been written documenting the great success of community schools. So talking to stakeholders, understanding their vision, introducing the idea of this research-backed idea that can help get to the vision, then working within the framework of a district, the system, to get a school board to support the growth of community schools, and then passing a policy, and then working your way to hiring your own community school coordinator.
So it doesn't seem easy, but there's hope.
So yes, it's tends to be hard, but if it was easy, someone would have done it already.
So we just heard some incredible success stories from a few states, and what you as part of NEA are doing on a personal and professional level to spread community schools throughout the country. But thinking about how we can continue to replicate this model in other places, what do you think are the core elements that make a community school successful? Why is it so magical?
I think that there's two parts to that answer. One is that I think that any educator that's out there knows there are panaceas that come into our school system that's saying, this is going to fix everything. And it worked here and it worked there. It's research backed and it's going to work here. You just have to do it with fidelity. And then all those educators know that 3 years from now, that strategy is out the window and some other new thing is coming in. So one is that you have to have strategies to sustain a strategy over the long term, because our institutions have superintendents that leave every 3 to 4 years, and they have principals that are leaving constantly. So the question is, how do you anchor a strategy? So we believe in the creation of coalitions that have our unions in them, but also other partners that are community organizers and United Ways and churches and other groups that can help a district sustain a strategy of improvement over the long term, as opposed to being distracted by the newest thing of the moment. So I would say that's ingredient number one, is forming a coalition and having the power to push a district to do the strategy, but also to keep it going. And then the second ingredient to this community school pie, if you will, is doing a best practice version of community schools. So community schools, saying the term, is almost like saying car. But there are a lot of different types of cars, aren't there? We have Maseratis, which is a fancy car for those who don't know, and we have jalopies, another word for like a car that's gonna break down all the time. So when we say community school, what are we referring to, actually? So when we do our studies about what the best community schools do, they do hire a coordinator and do a deep visioning and needs and asset assessment and do grassroots problem solving and form those partnership boards. But the best things that we've learned that differentiate community schools that achieve their vision and ones that don't is that they do a visioning process that allows for stakeholders, all stakeholders, to cast their opinion. Because we all know sometimes we invite people to a meeting and we only get the 5 parents that always show up and the 2 teachers that always raise their hand and the 3 student body presidents, right, or activists.
So what are some of the most creative solutions that you've heard of that a community school has implemented in order to make something better?
There are some interesting ones, and I think it's like the surprising things that end up getting you, right? I've heard of examples where they've added football and soccer to after school, and because they learn from students that, like, you wish that they would say math is why I go to school, or art or something, but they come to school because of football or soccer. So by adding those programs after school, you get them during school. So There are examples like that. Another example that was, I think it came from Reagan High School. That school, and if you know anything about Texas, like football is very important to them. And back in the day, they used to have a football team that was incredibly successful. And there were boosters back then who remember the good old days when football was shining. And when they did their needs and asset assessment and their vision, a lot of students expressed desire to join the football team, but they couldn't do it because they didn't have their health forms. It wasn't but a mile down the road to get a health form, but that transportation was an issue. So the school solved it by bringing in physicians and nurses to do those health assessments on site, and all of a sudden students were able to access the healthcare that they need so that they could join the football team so that they could then have a good football team and exist in happiness in Texas. I could tell you pharmaceutical companies, they don't get like the amazing drug the first time. They have to try and fail over and over, and that's what community schools do. They normalize the notion of failure so that they can get to success.
And I know that partnerships with the community or with outside organizations can be really key for community schools because they are a part of the community or they can help. How does the school interact with the external partners? Just like you were talking about the doctors, are there other ways that schools are reaching outside of their walls to get support that they need?
Certainly. So there's a study that was done on community schools that found for every dollar invested in this community school coordinator position that $14 follows that person. Meaning if you spend $1 million on a community school coordinator, I don't know anyone who's get paid that much money, $14 million other dollars would follow it. So community schools tend to strategically recruit resources that they need from a school. So one thing that everyone might be thinking is that I know lots of public schools that have partnerships, are those community schools? And the answer is kind of. A lot of traditional public schools have the elements of community schools. But what a community school does is inventory all of their vision and all the needs in order to achieve that vision so that they can form these partnerships, some form partnerships, with organizations that are strategic. So if you do a needs and asset assessment, for example, and you learn that 50% of the students can't actually see the smart board, it's smart board now, not a blackboard, right? And then what do you do? So in Cincinnati, at a school called Euler, which is a school where 85% of the students were dropping out by the 10th grade, and now 100% just applied for college, and 64% are getting into that college, at that school, there's a vision clinic inside that is profitable. So what the school did was provide the space for free for that vision clinic. And then there were their clients right there. 50% of them needed glasses, and now they can see the smart boards, and that's certainly a barrier to learning. You could be well-fed and come to school with the right state of mind, but still not be able to see things, and that could be frustrating, and then maybe you're acting out because you can't see the blackboard or whatever. And so everything is connected like a web, and you have to understand it deeply in order to be able to figure out a pathway to whatever respective vision stakeholders want or need.
So where does the money come from? Nothing's free, but if you are an early career educator and you're seeing that there are budget cuts in your school and you see that they're already cutting programs, but you want to ask for basically an overhaul of the way things run, how can you have that conversation with people about that money coming from a place that doesn't put their job in jeopardy? And how much are we really talking?
I'll answer the last question first. And we're really just talking about the cost of one person. Now, this person tends to be on the leadership team of a school. So they, if think about your lead teacher, someone who's been in the profession for a while that may be looking to become an assistant principal or principal one day, this is like they're occupying a position on the leadership team. So whatever in your district it costs to pay for an assistant principal, for example, or a lead teacher, that's how much it costs. So we're not talking about $1 million. Although I'd like to know the district that does, it does cost $1 million. So we're talking about something that isn't incredibly expensive. So I think that's really good to understand. We're talking about one person's salary.
Yeah.
But the question is, where does that money come from? So various districts have solved that in various ways. One mechanism, like in Los Angeles, they're paying for it through the district budget. Every district that I'm aware of the air you breathe is an austerity conversation. Like, there's not enough money to go around. So there's money in a lot of districts. Now, I know in rural districts, the conversation is quite different in terms of the resources that are there. But oftentimes, districts are creating new types of positions all the time. So we're just saying that this one position would be there. But to get to a place where beyond district dollars, sometimes foundations support, basically cut a check to a district to hire these community school coordinators. Sometimes the United Way will provide resources for it. We've written state legislation where the state then provides funding for community schools. And then federally, there's the Full Service Community School Program, where there's a great effort within our organization and other organizations to dramatically increase the funding for the Full Service Community School Program. It's currently funded at $17.5 million, and if you think about $2.5 million per school, that's mostly just a demonstration project, and we think it should be dramatically increased. So there's federal funds, there's state funds, there's city and county funds, and then district funds, and then private funds.
So community schools could, in theory, make the teaching profession easier, because instead of having to take on every role of, as you said, the parent, the social worker, the confidant, the therapist, you would get that through other partnerships or just hiring people whose jobs it is to actually do that, and making teaching a less stressful job, it sounds like.
Yeah, what community schools do is they kind of fix those things that are what we would call low-hanging fruit, and then they work on the high-hanging fruit, meaning low-hanging fruit, you can kind of reach it, right? And high-hanging fruit, those are more complex problems that it takes a little bit longer to solve. But for an early career educator that lands in a community school where they haven't somehow solved poverty, but they did figure out mechanisms to create solutions that mitigate the effects of poverty so that students can focus on learning and focus on becoming whoever they want to be when they grow up, that's a place where I'd want to work.
What would you say to the naysayers who argue that a school is for educating children and not for all of the other purposes that a community school might try to give it, such as vision center or community recreational center?
That argument makes a lot of sense in a vacuum, but not if you pull into all the layers that exist within the complicated nature of our society. So our society has structural racism and structural poverty and generations of harm that's been done, and inequity exists. And so the question is whether we use a research-backed solutions that has worked over and over and over to let children who had a dream actually achieve their dream, or we don't. And I think in a society that is supposed to be empathetic and is supposed to provide a free, high-quality public education for all, that if we know of a strategy that can help achieve the equity that we know exists, that could exist, we should do it. And I think that there are some that really do believe that these things should happen at home, and families, there's a notion in the United States that people should be pulling themselves up by their bootstraps. But if you don't even have bootstraps, or if you're existing in places that with families that can't provide those resources, it's not those students' fault. And oftentimes it's not the family's fault, because it has to do with something that came well before that. So either we lean in and we're empathetic and we do the strategies that don't actually cost a ton of money, we're talking about one full-time position to kickstart this, or we hand down to the next generation the same problems that we have today.
Thanks for listening. Make sure you subscribe so you don't miss a single episode of School Me. And if you find this podcast helpful, be sure to rate and review the show. It helps more people find us and the advice they need to survive their first few years in education. For even more tips and resources, you can visit us at neatoday.org/school-me.